Welcome to the 13th podcast episode of With Students in Mind. My name is Matt Townsley, and I am one of the two co-hosts tonight. Russ, welcome.
Hey, Matt. Tweeting out the link to the show.
This is our 13th podcast episode, our second live video podcast through Google Plus Hangout. We have a special guest with us tonight. Welcome, Scott.
Hi, everybody.
Mic check. Work. Mic. Check. Check. All right, we're good to go. We have asked Scott to join us. Scott, you have kind of a unique opportunity ahead of you. We'll get to that in just a minute. But my guess is more people know about you than they know about us. So we're not going to ask you to formally introduce yourself and what you do and all your accomplishments and so forth. Enough folks can just check out your blog at dangerouslyrelevant.org. We know about your work with Castle. We know about your Dangerously Relevant blog. Can you tell us something unique about yourself that maybe a few people know? Give you a chance to think about that. While you're thinking about that, maybe Russ could enlighten us. Russ, I understand you have a high school baseball fun fact. Tell our listeners about that.
I do. So, fun fact. You probably do not know that I am in the Iowa High School baseball record book for hitting two home runs in the same inning when I was a senior in high school. So now you know.
Wow. That's incredible. That's really incredible. How many others join you in the record book? Maybe that's a good question.
It's a fairly long list. It's at least 20 plus. Here's the interesting part. There are about, I think it was six. I forget whether there were six or eight. Two grand slams in the same inning.
Whoa.
That's just crazy.
Wow. That's pretty incredible.
Good for you, Russ.
Thank you. So what do you got, Scott? What's the interesting thing that that our audience would love to know?
Well, let's see. I guess first I could follow up on the baseball theme and say that I'm nowhere near any baseball record books. even though I'm a passionate fan of baseball, I was the kid who was always last on the bench. You know, I got my minimum at-bats and minimum innings. But, hey, that's the way it goes. Let's see. Some people know, but most people don't know, that I think I'm on an unofficial quest to be named the world's clumsiest human. So I do a lot of tripping and falling in places where you wouldn't imagine that would happen, like walking across the room. Oh, look, I broke my toe. And I think the penultimate points getter for me was when I was in New Zealand and I actually fell off the stage that I was at the conference I was keynoting and broke my elbow.
Wow.
So most people probably don't know all that about me.
What happens in New Zealand stays in New Zealand.
Yeah, I wish it did. Yeah. So I'm a walking hazard to myself, essentially.
There you go.
Fair enough. Well, you know, really, Scott, one of the main reasons that Russ and I asked you to be on tonight is because we're really interested about your current future. You know, we've followed your work. We've, you know, hung out with you a little bit face-to-face. Obviously, you live in Iowa. We both live in Iowa. Blogging, Twitter, all that stuff, too. You've worked at the University of Kentucky remotely for the past year. And before that, you're at Iowa State University, and before that, University of Minnesota, among other places. And many folks would know, if they followed your blog, that this year you'll be working for Prairie Lakes AEA in Iowa as the Director of Innovation. Can you tell us more about this position and maybe what you expect to be doing?
Sure. This is a new position that was created in the AEA. The AEAs have some new funding flexibility in terms of how they spend some of their media money. Rather than having to spend all of that on materials, they can now spend at least part of that on personnel and other services, I think. I'm not quite sure all the things they can spend it on. So after much conversation, AEA 8, Prairie Lakes, and I decided that it would be fun for me to spend, you know, at least a year and maybe more. We'll see how this one goes. as their new director of innovation. And this is, like I said, it's a new position. And so I'm on leave from the University of Kentucky from my job as associate professor of school leadership down there. And we're going to try and keep the good things that are happening in AEA8 moving right along. And then we're also going to try to build upon the successes they've had and try to move folks forward. So what we see in Prairie Lakes is that we have 45 to 55 school districts and private schools. And they're all over the map, as you might imagine, in terms of sort of the big task ahead of them, as I would call it. And that's, A, how do we move our students' learning environments so that they're more cognitively complex? How do we do upper-level thinking work, not low-level routine mental work? And then second of all, because pretty much all knowledge, meaningful knowledge work these days in the real world is done with computers, is how do we infuse technology into that upper-level thinking work in ways that are meaningful and powerful? So we've got some districts that are ahead of others. We've got some that are just raring to go. About maybe a fourth to a third of the districts are one-to-one and are giving laptops to kids or some kind of devices. And we've got others that are just starting to move these directions and everywhere in between. So really my job is to help resource and support the educators in those systems, primarily the leadership in those school districts and schools to make that happen. So that's kind of in a nutshell where we are. I don't think we really know what it's going to look like yet, and I'm sure you'll probably have some questions about that.
Well, it does lead into our next question. As you know, the name of our podcast is With Students in Mind, and so let's do a hypothetical here. If I'm a 10th grade student at Fort Dodge High School, how do you envision my classroom experience changing as a result of Scott McLeod's work at Prairie Lakes AEA?
That's a great question. You know, the challenges of working in an AEA are very similar to those working as a professor at the university. I don't have any direct supervisory control or authority over anybody. And so to the extent that my work, you know, the resources that I provide, the supports that I provide, the training that I do, the leadership that I exhibit, you know, the shaping of people's mindsets and behaviors, whatever, is very much of a sort of what we might call a persuasive leadership lens. You know, the best I can do is offer and support and resource and give and help, but ultimately it's up to the educators in a particular school like Fort Dodge High School or a particular district to take advantage of that and run with that and you know, people's willingness to implement and their interest, of course, is variable. And then even if they are willing, their ability to implement is variable, depending on their own personal skills, the context in which they're operating, the communities, both of staff members and parents and students that they're serving, and so on. So all that goes into play. You know, I can't just pop into Fort Dodge High School and say, well, I think you should do this, this, and this, and get rolling. Mm-hmm. The best I can do is try to be helpful and persuasive, and then hopefully support them as they work to make happen the things that they think ought to happen.
You know, you talked a little bit there, Scott, about working in AEA or higher education. You know, you've worked in your past, maybe your distant past, you worked as actual public K-12 educator, as a teacher. You've obviously worked in higher education as a professor and academic. You've written, you've blogged, you've done a lot of consulting, keynoting, workshops. I've been a part of your workshop. Yep. You do a really nice job, as I've told you. You've also been a consultant to schools and other public and private educational organizations, and now you're really, as you've just mentioned, an intermediate education agency support person, you know?
Right, yeah.
Let's just do a little dreaming here. Let's just say that you could start a school district here in Iowa with the help of some of your best acquaintances. What position do you, Scott, you know, maybe it's a principal, a superintendent, mm-hmm. central office, school board, teacher, support personnel, what position would you place yourself in really to have maximum effectiveness for this ideal that you've kind of set up for this student, this ideal learning environment that you kind of described for us today?
Sure. Well, and I'll start with the caveat that I love being a professor, and I'm really excited about this AEA role, even though they're indirect. I think quite a bit can be done, and I think one of the things we've seen through my work and the work of Nick Sowers here in Iowa, coming through CASEL, through the Iowa State University, is that even in an indirect role, you can have a pretty meaningful impact at a fairly large scale in terms of what happens to students and educators across the state. And often the advantage of being in a more indirect role where you live at a less local level is that you can affect more people. Maybe not as deep, but you can affect more people, so the scale and scope are different. And if you're persuasive enough, and if you do a good enough job of resourcing and supporting, you can actually see change happen in a number of organizations, not just one. So that's all sort of my caveat to your original question, is that, you know, I'm not knocking the AEA setup or the university setup at all. It's just recognizing it's a different set of parameters. If I got to pop into my own district, either a new one or an existing one, and I got to pick any role I wanted, I think absolutely I'd want to be the superintendent. I think that any level below that means that you're dependent on somebody else to facilitate systemic change across the organization. And so even though I've always said that my dream job would be to be an elementary middle school principal, whenever I'm done being a professor or AEA director or whatever, once and for all, bottom line is the superintendent has ultimate authority and influence over the entire organization, whereas if you're a principal, you're dependent on whoever's in central office and so on. Now, technically, the superintendent works for the board, right? But, of course, if you're a board member, you're just one of many, and then you get into all the competing politics. I think as a superintendent, I would be able to sufficiently resource and support and educate and persuade my board to move in directions that we needed to. And so I'm not concerned about having that layer of supervision above me. But I think, you know, the more layers you put above you, the harder it is to make change organization-wide. So I absolutely would want to be the superintendent.
It sounds like you've thought about this kind of question before. Have you? Have you thought about becoming superintendent?
I've actually thought about being superintendent. Sure, that's run across my mind multiple times. You know, it all depends on what kind of impact you want to have, how deep versus how broad, scale and scope issues again. I think it would be great to be a building level principal, and I think we see amazing things happening in schools where principals are making just awesome, awesome things happen in their buildings with students and with staff. But that's just one building, right? And as soon as your district is large enough to have more than one building, then what about all the other buildings? And so I always try to think about systemic change, and when I think about systemic change, and I think I want as many kids as possible immersed in, you know, learning environments for the next half century, not the last half century. And so the more classrooms I can impact, the more schools and systems I can impact, the better. So if I'm going to be in a school district, I'll at least want to be at the top of that pyramid, trying to facilitate change across and below and working with and for people, rather than middle management or lower level where your power and authority and influence is less.
So does that, seems logical to ask, does that effectiveness peak at any point? What about director of the Department of Ed or Arnie Duncan's role? You get what
right.
I'm saying?
Absolutely. Well, you know, you also get further and further away from the kids the more you're out. I still mourn some of my eighth graders that I used to teach, and it's been a long time since I taught them, believe me.
Taught eighth grade kids. No, I mean, You still teach, you're right. I mean,
yeah, but I mean, when I was a middle school teacher,
oh,
right? I mean,
gotcha,
that was
gotcha.
18 years ago, you know, and I still remember those kids quite well, and still wonder what they're doing and so on. You know, the further you remove from the kids, you know, the less direct influence you have in many ways. You know, is there a peak in terms of effectiveness? I guess it looks at what kind of changes you're making, you know. How much direct impact on the day-to-day behavior of classroom teachers can Arnie Duncan have as U.S. Secretary of Education? Probably not much. He can create policy environments. He can create, you know, maybe help facilitate legislative environments. He can create incentives for school systems to work in certain ways. But bottom line is, on a day-to-day basis, the teacher can go into his or her classroom and close the door and say, I don't care about you, Arnie Duncan. And we already see that happen just with their own building level principals, right? So when you add multiple layers above that, it just gets more and more remote. So it's, I'm not sure, you know, what the optimum level of influence is. You know, each level has its own affordances and its own drawbacks. You know, I think it's awfully hard to be a state-level director of ed like Jason Glass is here in Iowa because, you know, how much power does he really have in the grand scheme of things? He's beholden to the governor. It's very much of a political position. So I think, you know, we see examples already where, you know, Jason has personal beliefs about the way certain things should happen in education, and I'm not sure that he and the governor or he and Linda Fandel always agree. On what those should be. And so, you know, they have their own internal politics that are going on within the department and within the state government as a whole. And then he's got to somehow turn that around and manifest that out to AEAs and schools and districts. And, you know, a lot of what the Department of Ed does is they are paper pushers, right? They're handling all the compliance paperwork for federal grants and you know, state bureaucracy and so on. And so how much can he lead from that position? You know, how much can any director of education lead from that position? Much of it is force of personality, and how hogtied are you by bureaucracy and rules and, you know, decades-long cultures of dormancy and inactivity? I mean, I don't know.
Interesting.
I didn't mean to totally slam on DE because they do some good stuff, but you have to recognize that they're very much of a state government bureaucracy, right? And they're very much of a political entity. So,
great. Well, next question for you here, Scott. You know, we talk a lot on this podcast, for those of the faithful listeners that we have, about empowering students fairly often in this podcast. You know, sometimes we'll be all jib-jabbering on what we can do as adults, and we're like, well, what's this from the student's perspective, and what role could they play in this? So the next question there is, in your work with schools and as a parent of students, you know, I mean, you've got kiddos in public education in Iowa. What do you see as the most pressing issue that students could collectively rally around and, you know, make a positive change towards this ideal educational experience that you envision for kids in the next half of the century versus the last half? So talk to us about that.
I would really love to see a local or a statewide or a national movement of students where they really stood up for different kind of learning environments for themselves. I mean, this idea that only a handful of schools across the country, essentially, have figured out that we can put students at the center of their own education. And we can give them greater autonomy, we can give them greater agency, we can give them greater voice, we can give them greater control, we can tap into existing interests and passions in what they do. When we do so, they work their butts off rather than being apathetic. You know, when we give them powerful learning tools like laptops or netbooks or iPads, they do incredible things with them. If we don't box them in so tightly that, you know, they're so restricted they can't do anything, you know, what would a movement of any size, you know, local, regional, state, national, look like, where kids stood up and said, we deserve something better. Or we deserve something better than a 1940s educational model. We deserve something better that recognizes that, you know, and particularly as we get older, that we should be having greater control and voice and autonomy over our own learning. That you should be empowering us, not disempowering us. That it's ridiculous that I have, you know, way more learning power at home than I do in this formal institution that's supposed to heave out learning, right? What would that kind of movement look like, and how do we support it? Now, I don't think we're going to see that anytime soon for a number of reasons. One is that the kids who are old enough to maybe take that initiative on, right, and start advocating for themselves have also been schooled into massive compliance, right? They've been schooled out of having a voice. So by the time they're done with elementary, for the most part, they understand the rules of the game, which is are that if, you know, if you're a nail sticking up, you're going to get pounded. If you ask questions, you're going to get pounded. If you push back on your own learning environment, you're going to get pounded. The system will penalize you. Your educators who are supposedly looking out for you will, for the most part, shut you down. And so, you know, there's so much emphasis on compliance and going and playing the game of school and going along with whatever the system makes you do and forces you to do, and anybody who rebels at that gets quashed, and which is why, you know, we have so many kids who are brilliant and talented and interesting. And one of two things typically happens. Either they comply and they passively go along and they just shut themselves down and they play the game hoping that the next level will be something better, right? College or work or military or career or whatever. Or they actively rebel so much that the system essentially pushes them out. They get into alternative schools. They end up dropping out themselves because they just can't stand it anymore or whatever. And there's no way to accommodate sort of kids' individual learning paths and unique differences and their passion and interest because we have this model, this one-size-fits-all model. So, man, I would love to see a massive student movement that said, we deserve better, and this is what it could look like. But I don't think we're going to.
Well, you're making me think of what we can do. So in my role as a classroom teacher, you know, in Matt's role is in district office, and in your role now in the AEA is I guess I'm just thinking about always being on the lookout for the cracks in the system, so to speak, you know, where students can fit in and help them pry those open and just be that voice for them when I can. I'm trying to think positively, I guess.
No, absolutely. But I also think, for example, that if, you know, you were to take your middle school students or your high school students, Matt, and you would say, all right, let's talk a little civil disobedience here. Let's talk about what a respectful pushback on the system would look like. Let's talk about how do we make change happen in ways that are productive. You know, as an employee, you're going to get the heat pretty quick because the people who are above you, they're pretty, you know, one of the primary characteristics of most school administrators is that they're very controversy averse. Right, and here we got one of our own employees stirring up trouble with our own kids. Hey, Russ, cool it. Right?
Right. Well, yeah. This is not to take away from your point because I totally agree.
Yeah.
And it's also not me buttering up my administrators, but
yeah.
I am in the, and you know this, I'm in a very
sure.
lucky position that my administration all the way up to the top is not that controversy averse. You know, we take on that kind of stuff. We may not be taking the, you know, the giant leaps that, you know, that you're looking for, but I really believe that we're getting there.
Right.
And it's a mindset. You know, I really believe that our district has a mindset to work toward those things.
Yeah, well, and I like your district a lot, and I like your leaders a lot, but I wonder if, you know, if on the Monday of the second week of school, every kid showed up wearing a black armband that said My Education on it, right? If they started having sit-ins in the locker area or the cafeteria that said, we deserve something better than what you're providing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How open, I mean, maybe your administration would be open to having some conversations with students, but most would not.
Mm-hmm.
I see your perspective there too, Scott. You know, someone who was in the classroom now as a district person, I see doors that are open that weren't before.
Yep.
But at the same time, no matter where I've been, just like you said, just like Russ said, there is some sort of door that's open. And I think even for our students, there may not be as big of a door as the superintendent, for example, or even the teacher. I really do believe that there are doors open for the kids. And you're right, though. It does take the right adults in their lives to make it more than just a 30-second or 30-minute or one-day or two-day adventure, you know?
Right. Well, and we don't want it to be patronizing or condescending, right? Like, it should really be a genuine, authentic dialogue and conversation around what should learning and teaching and thus schooling look like. And I think most kids aren't prepared to have that conversation for a variety of reasons, part of which is just lack of life experience and understanding of what they could ask for. I think most adult educators and parents and community members aren't ready for that conversation because of their belief systems of what school should already look like. And, you know, and part of me is pessimistic just because I teach school law, right? So I see mm-hmm. hundreds of examples, you know, every year of kids getting quashed mm-hmm. By administrators. And these are not even, you know, taking into account students' interests and passions and maximizing maybe what they could be. These are constitutionally protected rights that get quashed, right? This is stuff that's set in stone in our basic legal document that still gets stepped on all the time, and they try to push back, and bam, you know, they get nailed. And so I see so much of that that with the few districts that I think are the exception here and there, I think in general the system is preserving itself.
So for the viewers, one thing, one pragmatic takeaway from this could possibly be, I know in our building we have multiple leadership teams. In our district we have the SIAC, the School Improvement Advisory Committee. Let's invite students onto those leadership teams. We've done that in our building on a couple of teams, inviting them literally to the table for those same conversations. And I think that's one, people might consider that small, but a practical, real example that you can take back to your building. If you want student voice, you have to ask for it.
Absolutely. And I think you have to do that in ways that are authentic, not patronizing. So I've seen too many adults, they'll create opportunities for students to speak and have voice, and then it's like, oh, that's so nice, and you pat them on the head and say, thank you so much, and then you just go on and do whatever you're going to do anyway. And students feel that in their gut, right? They know when we're giving them fake opportunities to be involved, and they know when we're marginalizing their input, even though we crow about, oh, we've got students on this committee or, you know, that initiative, but they, you know, but great. We've got it so tightly constrained that the decisions they do get to make are really about nothing that's really important, right? Like, how many schools give students input and maybe even control over the behavioral policies or the grading policies or what they get to learn that day or whatever? I mean, you know, just the really important decisions are not in any way, shape, or form typically influenced in any substantial manner by students.
Yeah, going back to what Russ said there, I can think of one personal big kind of what many I think would agree was a second order change or is the beginning of a second order change in our district. We had a couple students in the room, and what I was really happy to see is that it wasn't that patronizing, you know, thanks for coming type thing. It was a student, and granted, if we would have had a different student, it probably wouldn't have been this way, but one student who really was not afraid to say, you know what, here was the pros, but let me tell you how terrible it was in this one experience. And that was like, you know, as an administrator, as a teacher, you're kind of like, you know, like, got it, you know? But that's the reality I think that you're advocating for, Russ, there, is you want the raw student, not the sugar-coated student.
Right, and if you're going to give students voice, you have to be prepared for them to say things you don't want to hear. And you have to be prepared to act on that in ways that are real.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's all a sham.
Yep.
Right on. On a lighter note, Scott, Russ and I have spent a significant amount of time together in life, but most recently, we've been on the road together a little bit, plenty of windshield time, and one of the things we were just dying to know, which episode of With Students in Mind is your favorite one so far?
It's a great question. You know, they're all so good.
Sham!
No. So, you know, you guys don't do these enough.
True.
This is true.
Right? So there's sometimes long gaps between sessions and so on. I think my favorite is episode number 4. It's the one where you guys debriefed the very first Iowa One-to-One Institute. And that was just really fun to listen to you guys talk about sort of your reactions to that. I think Eric might have been part of that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And hearing you guys talk about, you know, what that experience was like. I think Eric was the one that said that he got 100 times out of what he paid for it, which was 0. So that was pretty funny. But, you know, as the person who put on the event and facilitated the event, it was great to just hear your reactions to that and hear the excitement in your voices as well as sort of the constructive criticism and thinking about how it could be improved. And, you know, the whole conversation around teacher readiness and whether or not can a school ever be ready? And how do we get staff to a place where they're receptive to new learning rather than just being forced to go and then grumping about it or being forced to go and then even when they're there and being exposed to powerful learning opportunities, just flat out rejecting it right there, even though it's right in your face that there's great stuff right in front of you. And you know, yeah, no thanks. I'd rather just complain. I mean, that's a whole interesting phenomenon to me. You know, your later episodes, I really liked episode 5 with Sean. I thought that was pretty good, too. Your later episodes have focused more on stuff that I haven't dealt with in a long time, stuff like formative assessment, or it's stuff that I am so immersed in my role as school leadership professor, like facilitating school change, right? You know, like the whole conversation you have with Jill Urich, for example. There was good stuff, but, you know, I'm sort of in a different place where maybe that didn't resonate with me quite the same. But that said, everything you guys talked about was real, it was meaningful, it was authentic, it's spot on with the needs of schools and so on. So, but I'm going to go with 4, not just because 4 is my favorite number, but also because you did a little name dropping in there and you talked about the Institute. I just thought it was good stuff. So, 4, for those of you watching at home.
4.
Good stuff.
Ross, did you have a specific episode you were secretly hoping he would say? I have one.
Well, yeah. I mean, we talked about this the other day. We both are. It's our favorite, and I really wish that everybody could have been there when we were at the train station in Osceola on the way to our first ISTE.
Yes, that's a great one.
That was.
That's a great one.
That's one that I will definitely make sure my son and my grandson and everybody watches someday. Right.
Well, you know what your best one was, though? I mean, it may not be your favorite, but your best one was 1.
We should listen to that again. It's been too long.
Well, and the reason it's your best one is because you dived in and you started.
Yeah.
Right? And then it's fun to watch you guys build over time. And you know, you start to build the repartee in this environment, not just the one you have informally as you know, relatives and friends and so on, but to figure out how to make this space work in ways that are productive. So,
cool.
All right, we got another question for you here. You are, I would say, well known as a player of Settlers of Catan.
Well known to the two of you.
That's right. Hey, that's well known. That's right. other similar games. Do you play Carcassonne?
We have Carcassonne, yes. We've been playing that more recently, yep.
And then Ticket to Ride? Are you Ticket to Ride?
Yes, we have Ticket to Ride, yep. My sons like that game in particular, yep. We do a fair amount of Ticket to Ride, yep.
Okay, and so here's the question. What game or games should our viewers be playing that they may not have heard of? So we want you to do the hipster thing right now.
Okay. So we just bought a bunch of new ones. We went to Board Game Geek. And sort of went down the list and said, all right, what's out there that's highly rated that looks pretty interesting? And so we just bought Dominion, we bought Puerto Rico, and then the two that I'll recommend, because we've been playing those most recently, Citadels is really fun. It's in a small box, and what you're trying to do is you're trying to build a city, but you have rotating roles each round. So one round you might be the king, which gives you certain powers. Another round, you might be an assassin, which gives you certain powers, like preventing somebody else from taking their turn. Another round, you might be a merchant, which allows you to build property faster and get your gold back. And then each round is pretty quick. So within just 3 or 4 minutes, typically, you're playing a different hand in a different role, which causes you to behave completely differently. Yeah. And you get to pick. There's a rotating choice of which role you have. So the strategy comes in, all right, for this round, which role do I need to try and be in order to maximize my outcomes for this round as you try to be the first one to build your city. So Citadels is pretty fun. We've been playing a lot of that. But absolutely, I think my favorite right now is Agricola, where you're a farmer. How about that?
Hey, there you go.
And it's very complex, and it's very complicated, but you start by playing the family rules, which simplifies it quite a bit. And there's hundreds and hundreds of cards that affect the game. And in the family version, you leave them out completely. And you just start with something that's more Catan-like in complexity. And even so, every time you have a turn, you have to choose between what may be 20 to 30 different options and try to figure out what's the best one for you at that time. And you're trying to cross your fingers and hope other people don't steal the option that you want because then you're out of luck and so on. So anyway, Agricola, which is Latin for farmer, is actually really fun. And so it's sort of Catan-like in that you've got fields and you've got, you know, sheep and cows and wild boar and you're raising grain and vegetables and so on. But absolutely, that should be the next game you guys buy.
All right.
Scott, did you play board? Did you play board games growing up? I kind of. Go ahead.
Yeah, we had a lot of games when I was a kid, particularly at my grandma's house. They were more the typical kind of games, you know. We'd play Sorry, we'd play Monopoly, we'd play Parcheesi, we'd play Checkers, we'd, you know, do Rummy Cub, we'd do sort of, you know, Trouble with the Pop-Up Bubble, and you know, we'd do all the sort of traditional games that we had as kids, you know, Life and so on. So yeah, we've always been game players, lots of card playing in my family growing up. And,
In Life, did you go the college route or the not college route?
Oh, no, we always went the college route. My goodness.
Okay. I thought you would, but, you know.
And, hey, well, it's funny, because in real life, I'm the first college graduate in my family. But
oh,
in life, we knew it was important to go the college route.
All right. Ross, did you play? Were you a board gamer growing up?
We're more cards. Played a lot of cards. Played a lot of euchre. A lot of euchre.
I thought for sure Scott would say, I just played Risk all the time.
I'm
a Risk guy.
I have a lot of Risk and a lot of Stratego in my background.
Stratego, the bombs, I love that game.
Absolutely. And my kids love those games today. So we just played Risk about a week ago. So there's also a fantastic card game, if you can ever find it on eBay, it's called Palabra, P-A-L-A-B-R-A. But it's out of print, and the copies on eBay are often quite expensive. But if you can get it, it's really fun. So.
Cool. Well, you know, we've kind of had the serious part of the night. We've had the kind of the fun part here at the end. Scott, is there anything else that you're just itching to share with our, you know, probably thousands of listeners right now?
Absolutely, tens of thousands. Maybe hundreds of thousands.
Just our spouses, too, could be.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see, what am I itching to share? It's Connected Educator Month, so if you're not paying attention to that, there's going to be some interesting goings-on over the course of the month. I did my panel session today, and that was really fun. I would say keep an eye on my blog, because I have permission from the AEA to publicly share whatever I do for the AEA with the rest of the world. So as I create resources and find ways to support those folks there, you know, you'll see a lot of that manifest itself in my blog and other online resources. So pay attention to Twitter and my blog. And that's not a desperate plea for, you know, followers. I'm just telling you that's where it's going to be.
Well, was that so? Was that part of the negotiation? Like, what did you bring that up and kind of say that's part of getting
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think, you know, whatever great stuff we do within EA as a result of my work with them is going to have value to others as well, right? And so we want that to be shareable. And so, yes, part of my contract actually explicitly states that the AEA and I have joint ownership over any work products. And we had the explicit conversation up front about public sharing and making everything Creative Commons and so on, so that it can just, you know, to the extent that it's useful or helpful to others, that it'll be out there. And I wish that we saw more of those kind of contract negotiations or those considerations just built right into staff contracts. I mean, what a great message it would be in a teacher contract to say, whatever you make, you know, we're not going to try and lock it down under some kind of crazy work product idea, but, you know, it's an expectation of this district that anything you make can be shareable, and we hope that it also will be shared by you to the outside world. You know, what a great message that would send to new hires.
Sounds like something that would fit right into a social media policy.
Yeah, wouldn't it? Instead of a restriction, how about an enabling? How about an encouraging?
Love it.
Yeah, so do I get to ask you guys questions, or is that not okay? It's your platform.
Well, do we have time for that? I don't know. Fire away.
Yeah.
So let me flip at least one of these around on you guys and say, you know, because I don't really know what the folks are going to want from me. The month of August and part of September is really going to be where I do intake sessions virtually, many of them will be virtual, with leadership teams from all the different districts and schools and say, you know, let's spend half an hour to an hour together and just tell me, where are you with things? What are you trying to do? What are you trying to make happen? Where are you struggling? Where do you think I might be able to help? What kind of resources and supports do you need? Recognizing that it's, somewhat indirect to the AEA. I'm going to be having those conversations with every district, I hope, and the leadership teams there. And it's going to be fascinating for me to see if, what I think some of their needs are actually what their needs are, and how do we pull those together. So I don't know, when I look back at the end of this month, where will my priorities be? What will I be working on to best serve them? I have some ideas in mind, of course, coming in, and I have some overall objectives that I think, we would like to see happen across the board. But so much of it is going to be shaped by sort of the feedback they give me about their needs and interests through these intake sessions. So if you can imagine me coming to you and saying, let's talk about what you need and whatever. If your AEA had a director of innovation, what would you like to see that person do?
Oh. Russ, you got this one, buddy?
I'll think about your question in two ways. One would be how you ended it, if my AEA had a director of innovation, but then also if it was specifically you who was in that position. So
sure.
Thinking with it being you, first of all, I would love for you to use your influence to spotlight what you see in classrooms.
Yep.
And I know you saw this coming from me. I'm big on this. I would love if you were just – and I'm not saying that you need to be in buildings and stuff. I realize that that's not what your role is. But if you're talking to the leadership teams and you're talking to administrators and finding out who are the people that – because I'm a believer in pockets of innovation because if those pockets are then pushed out, by the administrators and whoever. And so I feel like you are in a great position to find those pockets mm-hmm. and expand them. So I guess that's what I would be looking for in any director of innovation is find the innovation that's currently happening. And it's not all going to be happening. There are things that you want to see that are just plain aren't happening. But, there are innovative – there is innovative teaching and innovative learning going on, and find it and blow it up. Show everybody what's happening.
Yep.
I think I go along with that. As a kind of district guy now, I think one of the things I'm really interested in, I'm kind of interested in like typologies and frameworks and that type of thing, Scott. So, maybe, and only you know what your future is at Prairie Lakes after 1 year. But I'd like to see you create, maybe you already have, kind of like here's the big pillars for what a school would look like. And then underneath each big pillar is kind of like a continuum, but also not just a continuum, but also some examples of what that would look like in the classroom, kind of going off of what Russ is saying, so that schools could do kind of like an audit, if you will. And I know this because I, full disclosure, I helped you out one time at one of the schools that you were working with, and I think that's what I gathered you were trying to help them do at that time, was kind of get a big picture of what's going on in your district and where are these pockets of excellence. So you're going to be really strong in this pillar of this innovative school, but you're really weak in this pillar over here. And so as a school district, as a district guy, I'd like to kind of know from an outside perspective, someone that's well-respected in the field, to know where our relative strengths and weaknesses. Because one of the things I'm big on is I like to have focus. And I'm not – one of my weaknesses is I'm not a great dreamer. I'm not – Russ is the dreamer in our little partnership here, and I'm kind of more of the nuts and bolts practical guy. But it works out well for us when we work together. But I'd like to have someone kind of be that dreamer for me so that then I can say, here's where we need to focus, and then just plow forward from there. And I think you're really the guy, a director of innovation, especially you, could do that because you have been in so many different schools, across the world. You work with so many different administrators. I think you could create kind of a framework if you haven't already. And then you can leave that at the AA if you would choose to move on and,
sure,
whatever your future is.
Right. So that's an interesting idea. You know, we've been playing around a lot recently with sort of various self-assessments, right? And nothing real systematic or scientific. You know, it can be something simple as an administrator, run yourself or your leadership team against the NetsA. How do you think you're doing? Or take Will Richardson's characteristics of what a bold school looks like and how do you think you're doing on those? You know, there have been probably, I'd have to go dig these out, but there probably have been typologies made that talk about sort of what an effective school looks like, right? Like we had the whole effective schools movement, and whether we're talking about what an effective teacher does or what an effective principal does or what an effective school does, we have those frameworks. You know, we have those grids and continua and, you know, evaluation scales and so on. And here are the six things that effective schools do, and, you know, validated by research and so on. I think the challenge is how do you frame that in sort of a contemporary and future context so that we say, well, great, that's what an effective school looked like 30 years ago, right, or in the early 80s. And that's great. We still need to be doing all of those. But there's this whole wave of new things that we also need to be doing, right? Like it's not enough just to be have strong levels of academic equity across the student population, right? But there's also a digital lens that gets laid over that. And so, you know, I don't want to reinvent the typology of the effective schools movement or what do we look for in an effective teacher or what are the things that the best principals do and so on. But we could maybe come up with a typology that overlaid on top of those and that said, here's a new typology of considerations, some new things to be thinking about related to, you know, how do you know if your classroom structures are cognitively complex as opposed to, you know, simply regurgitation of low-level work, right? That would be a different kind of lens on sort of the academic robustness that's happening in the classroom sort of thing. You know, what kind of questions would you ask about bandwidth? What kind of policies you need in place around employees and students? So I'd want to keep sort of higher level thinking work and technology and infusion lens into whatever typology that we might make. But that's an interesting challenge. I'll have to think some more about that and whether or not that's, I mean, it's sort of daunting to think about what that might look like. And to do that in a way that wasn't so high level that it was basically useless. Like it was just a bunch of meaningful phrases and yeah, that sounds good. And when I read the NetsA, when I read the essential conditions, for example, they're great, but there's not enough detail in those to be really helpful to anybody. You know, great, so you need a visionary leader. Well, yeah, fantastic, thanks. Great, you need policies that facilitate systemic reform and change, particularly around technology integration. Well, great, but let's break that out a bit, right?
Yeah.
kind of thing. So I think that's the kind of thing where I could maybe be helpful, and I appreciate you saying that. I'll have to think some more about whether that's doable, and if so, what forms it might take. Russ, I'm dead on with what you said around capturing what's going on now that's going well and sharing that story more broadly. We do a terrible job in education of sharing in concrete, tangible, visible ways what we're striving for, right, or what's already happening that's excellent. The rare Edutopia channel aside, right, you know, when most teachers say, I want to see what effective one-to-one teaching looks like in a secondary math classroom, right, I mean, fair enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? We should be, I mean, there are effective educators out there right now doing a bang-up job with kids and technology and high-level thinking skills, and we just don't have anything to show them. And there's no reason we can't get in there with video cameras and capture some of the action live in classrooms and interview teachers and interview students and so on. And I've already started to have that conversation with the AEA. They apparently have a fantastic video guy who, what I hear, is perhaps underutilized. And what I'm really hoping that we can do over the course of this year is go find some of those pockets, go find some of those places, and really capture and tell those stories and share those more broadly. And again, not just within the AEA, but, you know, nationwide and worldwide so that other people can start bouncing back and pushing back and reflecting off of and saying, I like that, I don't like that, I can see how I could do that tomorrow, and so on. That's really what we need. I'm a big believer in models and examples, and so, you know, video speaks to us in ways that no other medium does, and so we need to be utilizing more of that in ways that work.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
You guys both answered that question from the lens of me personally, so it's you've already started thinking of me as the director of innovation, not a director of innovation.
I don't know if I've ever heard of one before, so it's tough to extrapolate it out.
I think that should be your proposal to your school district, Russ, that you're the next director of innovation for your district.
I like my classroom.
I know, it's hard.
It is, it's, yeah.
All right, well, Matt, that's another hat you can wear then.
So. Hey, hey. As you can tell, look what happens when you wear lots of hats.
I really wish we could get a director of innovation in every AEA and in the State Department. That would be fantastic, right? Wouldn't it be great if we could give permission to somebody in every organization to be the rabble-rouser, to be the guy, to be the visionary pushback person, right? Okay, Susie, you've been doing a great job as a leader in our district for the last 5 years. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to give you permission to push as hard as possible and to push our thinking as forward as possible without any fear of retribution. Right? You have a free and open organizational space to think differently, to push differently, and we may not do most of what you advocate for, but at least we want to set you up in that role where you can do that. Right, without any fear of, you know, harm to your career or whatever. So we're going to give you that open space to just do that. That would be cool.
That I would take that and keep from the classroom. Yeah. I would love that.
Right.
This question just kind of came to mind, Scott. Will you do much work within the AEA itself? You know, like I've heard you talk a lot about working with the. You know, just for those that maybe aren't from Iowa, the AEA is an intermediate education agency that has, you know, administrators and like central office folks and folks that just work in the agency. Then, of course, there's a lot of folks that work out in the field. I've heard you talk a lot about working with the schools that the intermediate agency serves. But my guess is there's some innovation that could be happening within the agency itself. Is that part of your charge, or are you more charged with working with the schools in which the agency serves?
My primary role is serving the field, serving the schools and educators and students and communities. There is a component of my job that's, of course, yet to be defined. We'll see how it goes as we go along. I'll be following sort of the lead of Jeff Herzberg, the chief administrator there, about what kind of innovation do we want to start thinking about within how AEA does its work. You know, it's going to be an interesting challenge because the vast bulk of what they do, of course, relates to special education. And you can only be so innovative within that complex bureaucracy and federal regulations and so on. And to be honest, you know, my familiarity with what, you know, I know the legal side of special education, but my familiarity with the day-to-day workings of special ed directors and speech therapists and teachers' aides and so on, you know, that's not where I live. That's not the space that I do. And it would be rather arrogant of me to just come in, even with somebody's blessing from above, and say, all right, let's shake up your system. But I do think that we can have conversations around, you know, just like we would have with a classroom teacher or a principal or whatever, about ways to maybe rethink some of the ways that we do things and take advantages of sort of new typologies and new information landscapes and new learning tools and so on to do our work in ways that might work better for us, save us time, make us more productive and so on. So I'm not quite sure yet what that kind of internal work within EA will be. There will be some, and I think we'll sort of figure that out as we go along. But primarily it's mostly working with folks in the field.
Cool.
I think it's going to be. I'm excited just to roll up my sleeves and, you know, I already did so much work directly with schools and educators, even though I was in an ivory tower research institution. And to have the chance to just go even deeper over the next year, you know, and I'm grateful for University of Kentucky to give me this leave so that we can try some things and do some interesting work here. And, you know, we should have another one of these in June and we'll be like, hey, how'd it go?
Hopefully it's not number 14.
Yeah, that'd be good. That'd be good.
Scott will always be remembered as Lucky 13.
Again. Yeah, all right, cool. Very nice. Thank you.
Cool. Scott, you have any, you know, closing, parting comments? I know you got kids and probably some tweeting and things to do yet.
No, not really. I mean, I think, you know, the old saw of Gary Steger always comes to mind, which is the more that we can facilitate environments where there's less of us and more of our students, the better. I've been thinking about that a lot, is how do we create autonomous, empowering environments for kids? And how do we just give up our need to be so controlling? It's astounding how, as adults, the various things that we put in place that limit kids and their power, even at very young ages, when we know just from looking at other schools that have gone these directions that, you know, we have 6-year-olds that could astound us if we let them. And sure, you got to get the basics covered, and you've got foundational knowledge to occur, and you've got all the social stuff and whatever. But bottom line is, we're holding our kids back. And so hopefully, you know, we'll make some progress on that this year within the AEA and the schools that we're serving. And I think we have to give ourselves permission to be learners. But I think that also carries with it a concurrent responsibility to be a learner. And so those educators that we talked about before that show up at the one-to-one conference, they're like, I was forced to be here. I'm not going to get anything out of this. I've already decided that, and then they don't. Or the educators who look around at the world as it is now and want to basically ignore it, say, I want the world as it was 15 years ago, and damn if I'm not going to do everything I can to make sure that happens. You know, we need environments of permission from policymakers and school leaders and so on to be learners, but we also have to be willing to take that up ourselves as educators. And so, you know, what will that look like in the AEA in the schools this year? I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what sort of cultures of experimentation are out there. So those are just some things that are kind of buzzing around my head right now.
Anything you want to add, Ralph?
Thanks for joining us. I was very pleasantly surprised that you knew our back catalog fairly well.
I'm on it, man. Particularly if you give me a little bit of warning so I can review.
That's right.
That helps.
Scott, do you remember when Russ and I first met you?
Oh, hard to say. Was it at some iTech conference?
It was.
What? Jeez.
In Coralville?
Oh, yeah.
How far back was that? 3 years? 4 years?
Yeah, probably 4 years ago.
I don't know. I remember you sort of being pretty skeptical right from the get-go, Matt.
Oh, just me? Just me? What?
Rush, you know what I'm talking about, don't
you?
Oh,
yeah.
I don't know, Scott. Sounds like a whole bunch of pie-in-the-sky stuff.
We were reminiscing on the drive home about the three of us, Eric, Matt, and I, sitting at Matt and Eric's parents' table at Thanksgiving, going back and forth with you on one of your comment threads about something. I don't remember what it is anymore, but...
And then somebody got invited to the Will Richardson event, and it was that guy!
Oh, yeah. Good times.
I love it. What do you remember about that first meeting?
You're taller than I pictured.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's about what I remember, too.
So you don't remember the healthy skepticism and intense questioning you directed my way.
I think you're making that up. I really do.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on, Scott.
I always love hanging with you guys. So anytime.
Well, we have a little tradition of ending our podcast. I don't know if you know this, Scott, but maybe you do since you've listened in. We should really test him and see if he can fill in the blank. But we won't put him on the spot. Well, maybe we should.
I'm trying to remember how you guys end. I don't know. I don't think I recall.
Well, maybe we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. It's probably the music overlaying. You can't. In the old podcasts, we did a little post production, added some music and so forth.
Right. Sure.
So we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. But we always end by reiterating the reason that we are here. We are here with students in mind.
Oh, students in mind. That's right. Okay.
All right. Have a good one, everybody. Thanks,
Scott. Bye, guys. Thanks.